Carolyn McAfee and rowing back to the wilder shores.
Thank you. Well, just 2 or 3 days after Chris persuaded me to emerge blinking into the sunlight to give this talk, where a combination of fleeching, she said I was well kent as a steerer, and bribery, she said I could sell copies of Wolf Curtaloo's novel. Just a couple of days after that, as I say, I happened on this querious wee book, the 1963, Forbes McGregor's The Gowks and Mowdy Nows. Has anybody come across this book? No, nobody's read this. The Scottish Poetry Library very kindly provided me with a picture of the dust jacket, because the copy that I hae has now got its jacket. I'll pass it round so you can hear we look at it. I'll read you a wee sample of Forbes McGregor. The language spoken by the ordinary inhabitants of the parish was a dialect of Scots, much intermixed with English. This blending of languages now began to give great offence to McGrumpy and his friends, and sent them one day walking up and down the high street of Mowdy Nows after the manner of Ezekiel, holding large shearer's baps, or tuppenny rolls, in their right hands, and spreading upon them with their left generous helpings of bull's dung. McGrumpy proclaimed that the baps exemplified what he described as a full canon of Scots, and the bull's turd was the defiling Southron tongue. He there and then publicly declared his intention of using only the ancient and now neglected tongue of the land, and in this declaration his disciples joined him. It's a mischievous satire on Hugh McDermott. I was actually thinking while Bob was speaking that I come to bury McDermott, not to praise him, except that I think he's beyond burying by me or by anybody else. So it's a satire on McDermott and his followers, including jabs at their Honlan of the language, which they rename Merse Clash. So Merse Clash would be border spick, right? The language of the Merse. Although the Merse is the wrong end of the border for Hugh McDermott. But anyway, the point about Merse Clash is that it's in contrast to Erse Clash. So that's Phelan spick. In other words, what McGregor is getting at is that Merse Clash is Lallans. And the chief gowk, McGrumpy, uses another language for by, a deed language, with words into it like yowtrummel and onding. So, in effect, McGregor is accusing McDermott of treating Scots as if it was a deed language, and thereby available to an intellectual elite to play with as they like, without objection to the actual spickers. But it's as a spicker of Scots that McGregor cries doon the gowks. His view is an interesting one, I think, because he focuses on the success of the gowks in destroying respect for the existing tradition, rather than on their own work. As he says, whatever works had been produced by their ancestors of the previous century and a half were to be heaped with contumely or damned as the creation of mediocrity. There is, forby, an elaborate satirical episode where McGrumpy usurps the national poet Macardus, in other words, Burns. As Colin Milton said, discussing McDermott's jealous attacks on the poetic tradition of the Northeast, and in Charles Murray in particular, it is clear that the background to Grieve's hostile comments on Murray and his milieu was the prominent, even predominant, place in the vernacular movement of the time occupied by Scots from the Northeast. And likewise, on McDermott's relationship with the Burns movement, Milton says, I have become increasingly convinced that he and his allies were beneficiaries, if ungrateful ones, of the vernacular movement rather than its inspirers, and that his attacks on the movement are eloquent testimony to its influence. Hamish Henderson made the ilk pint in his flighting with McDermott in the letters pages of The Scotsman in 1964, when he accused McDermott of kicking away one of the ladders on which he had skimped to greatness. Now, I'm going to tell you three brief stories, which are, in fact, the same story. First of all, about Latin. Now, my Latin is guy rusty, so bear with me, but hopefully I'll get the point across. As early as Erasmus, the early 16th century, scholars deplored the existence of different pronunciations of Latin and the absence of an international standard. To the extent that only a particular national pronunciation was admired, it was the Italian, which is how I recommend it for singing, as well as being the model for Kirk Latin, although Kirk Latin has been through a process of reform in the 20th century as well. The rise of comparative philology in the 19th century made it possible to reconstruct classical Latin pronunciation accurately, and this was gradually imposed in the United States no long after 1880, and in England in 1907, with only some of the public skills holding out. In Scotland about the same time. I haven't quite got it clear in my mind what was going on in Scotland. There was a report by the Classical Association, that was the Classical Association of Scotland. They had to cry themselves the Classical Association of Scotland after the Classical Association was created in England, and they just cried themselves the Classical Association. The Classical Association. The English, as is the way of things. So anyway, this report came out in 1905, and the reformed pronunciation seems to have been accepted in Scotland as well. But it wasn't such an upheaval in Scotland, because the tradition in the skills was, in any case, to use the continental values of the vowels. In England, the pronunciation of Latin in the classroom had got way out of line with the Italian, for instance, because of the great vowel shift. I mean, some of you will be familiar with that. The massive sound changes that took place in English and in Scots by about 1700. And that had the effect of making the vowel system out of step with most other languages. But all the nationalities in Europe had their own pronunciation of Latin, because it had evolved alongside the vernacular. So there was a French pronunciation, but they nasalised everything. And there was a German pronunciation, and there was an English pronunciation, which was felt to be in need of reform, particularly because the vowels was way out of step with all the continental styles. In Scotland, there must already, even before the reform, there must have been a discontinuity between the pronunciation that was taught in the skills with the continental values of the vowels and what was used by lawyers. Because if you're familiar with the Concise Scots Dictionary, there's quite a lot of Latin phrases in there, Scottish legal Latin phrases in the dictionary. And when Jack Aitken did the pronunciation entries in the early 1980s, he consulted Scottish lawyers for their pronunciation of these phrases, and they're quite clearly nativised. So for instance, you have a phrase like Dominus Litis, L-I-T-I-S. It's no Dominus Litis that lawyers were or are saying. It's Dominus Litis that's gone through the great vowel shift. Cessio Bonorum. It's not Cessio with a hard C, a deformed pronunciation. It's Cessio. De Fideli, F-I-D-E-L-I. Now, where the reformed pronunciation would be Fideli, lawyers were saying Fideli. Delectus Personae, with an A-E ending. Judicatum Solvi, with a letter I at the end. Legitim, rather than legitim, with a hard G of the reformed pronunciation. So as I say, the problem must already have existed, that you would learn Yin Latin in the classroom and then you'd go into the legal profession and find that it pronounced it differently. And it makes you wonder as well, what about medics, pharmacists, other folk that were using a lot of Latin in a vernacular way? They probably had their own nativised pronunciations as well, but this might be lost in the mists of time now. When I did Latin in the early 70s, my teacher was saying the V pronunciation, Veni, Vedi, Vici. So there must have been, you know, a degree of variation there. And I think it's only quite recently that Latin teachers have been lined up against a wall and told that they had to say the W of the Reform pronunciation. So anyway, the effect, as the critics of the Reform had said all along, was to obscure the relationship between English words and their Latin etymons, and to make folk unsure about who to pronounce Latin names and phrases when they used them in an English context. So, for example, was it to be Regina or Regina? Was it to be data or data? Was it to be minutiae or minutiae? And this was all very unsettling. Whereas educated folk had been accustomed to dropping Latin tags into their newsen, like they would lines for Shakespeare or lines for Burns, knew they got self-conscious about it. And Yin Observer commented in 1930, "Latin has become lately a dead language, in a sense in which it was not dead before. In my younger days, in any company of educated men, Latin quotations would be as familiar and as readily understood as household words. Today, no one dare quote a Latin line because he's uncertain if his hearers will understand his pronunciation." There was a similar point made after Erasmus published his thoughts on the inaccuracy of Latin pronunciation at the time. There was an attempt at Cambridge University to reform Latin pronunciation, which doesn't seem to have really taken. But for a while, the younger scholars were making some reforms, and there were complaints that it was making the younger scholars impudent because they were enjoying having a pronunciation that they felt was correct and that older scholars didn't understand. Coming back to the reforms of the 1905-1907, at that kind of time, Money Folk Sinsign has shared the view of Yin Educator that the confusion and damage of the forced introduction of the restored classical pronunciation system into English and American schools at the turn of the century was a significant factor in the decline of Latin in the school curriculum. That's my first cautionary tale. Secondly, in 1957, Noam Chomsky published Syntactic Structures. This was the final dunt to traditional grammar, which had already been almost pushed out of the skill curriculum by the growth of English literature as a subject. To quote for a discussion of Chomsky's impact, "If most of language is innate, as Chomsky claims, then language teaching, that is, the teaching of native language, is largely irrelevant." Now, traditional grammar had its problems. It was based on Latin grammar, say, and some points it wasn't descriptively adequate for English, which added, of course, to the difficulty of learning it. And there was no evidence that studying it improved Behrens' writing. Transformational generative grammar solved none of their problems. It was abstruse, it was difficult, it was deductive. Say, it wasn't ident about describing actual language either. There was no evidence that studying it improved Behrens' writings neither. And in addition, the theory of transformational generative grammar was continually changing and getting more and more Heath Robinson-ish. You'll mind, John, the various patches that they kept trying to clute in to accommodate actual data or data. Chomsky and his followers did, however, do a guy-thorough hatchet job on traditional grammar. Grammar is now coming back into the English curriculum in skills, and it's recognisably traditional, though it's informed by modern developments since, but 2 generations at least as skill teachers lacks the skills to teach it. And English as a subject has lost its rigour to the extent that universities isn't demanding it as an entrance qualification anymore. I'm telling my daughter to do Latin instead. In both these cases, there was a paradigm shift among the elite that the new orthodoxy failed to braid outside of the classroom, outside the university classroom in the case of Chomsky's grammar. The attempt to destroy what had went before did, however, produce a cultural discontinuity, snedding off traditional practices and destroying cultural capital. The effect of this is seen in small ways, such as parents not being able to help parents with their skill work. And when this extends out our money fields of knowledge, it amounts to a general breakdown in the transmission of culture between generations. My third story, as you'll maybe have guessed, concerns the orthography of Scots. There is a traditional orthography. It goes back to Alan Ramsay, and more importantly, it's familiar for the Scriven of Burns. As McDermott Kent, when he minted at the Provençal poet Frederick Mistral, an iconic marker, like Burns, often fixes the canonical form of a language. There was only two real problems with the traditional spelling system. There was the spray of apostrophes, as Louis Grassett Gibbon cried it, and there was the ambiguous double O spelling. Now, the apostrophes, as we can, was felt to be apologetic because they related the reduced forms of Scots to the full forms of English. Though there's no doubt that that is helpful to readers whose literacy is and always will be primarily in English. And you might just as well cry them etymological spellings because they relate the Scots to the earlier forms of Scots as well. But the double O in words like shin, S-H-O-O-N, and abin, A-B-O-O-N, led to spelling pronunciations. That was a genuine problem. But it wasn't a problem in words like hoose. However, McDermott's Folliers, despising the Cale Yeard and the cult of Burns, looked back to Middle Scots for inspiration, and some of them, including Albert Mackay and Sidney Goodsir Smith, attempted to deafoot the graphemes introduced Synd and Barr's time and tried forby, as you can, to restore the distinction between the present participle ending in IN and the verbal noun ending in AN. And almost as soon as the Scottish style sheet was published, it was drawn up in 1947, it was published in Lyne's Review in 1955, and almost immediately Tom Scott was saying, I think instead of IN and AN, it would look better if I wrote ING and AND. So even the folk that was thorough to the style sheet was offered tinkering with it for the word go. Oddly enough, that IN-AN distinction was used by Burns, but just in the first edition of the poems, and no in later ones. David Murison wrote about this in an article in 1959, when I was three. You see, there's no corroborative evidence for the survival of this distinction in the Ayrshire of Burns' time. The only evidence is Burns Yezy Joe. There's nothing else to stand witness to it in that dialect at that time. Though it did survive into the 20th century in apocal peripheral dialects, including in the Borders, so it is possible that that Burns made the distinction in his own spec. Well, I never can, really. So, as I say, the new spelling practices was yearned by the Makers Club and clap it into shape as the 1947 Scots style sheet. But that was only the beginning of attempts at spelling reform, as we all can. The existing tradition was discredited, but the subsequent campaign to produce the ideal Scots orthography left no winner in the field, because, unfortunately, standardisation depends no on the creation of a perfect system, but on the ruthless smearing of its maybe equally perfect rivals. MacDiarmid hissel scribed within the Ramsay tradition. I should maybe have passed Rún Uair Uaillí earlier on. The Ramsay tradition continues to this day, not just in the Sunday Post, but in the Spelling o' Naive Writers of Scots, which includes many of the skill teachers now called upon to encourage Scots writing among bairns. MacDiarmid published a letter in Lang's Review in 1968, announcing that he intended to instruct his literary executors. I don't know if he ever did, but that was his intention at the time, probably lasted about 5 minutes, announcing that he would allow his eclectic work in the future to be put into the style sheet orthography. But he was pocky and youth, no to kick away the ladder of tradition as well while there was Nathan Sicker in its place. Now, I would argue that the sum total of Mearner 60 year of Scots spelling reform has been to get rid of the twa spelling problems that I mentioned earlier, at least among folk with some awareness of the issue, though there are yeas and apostrophes in the Sunday Post. By coincidence, Clive Young posted on Facebook the other day. This is the first time I've cited Facebook in an academic paper. But it's a very good point that he made, and he sent me the figures to back it up when I speared at him about it. He said, I worked out yea time that since the 1930s, the Bruins and Uair Uaillí atween them, money produced about 2 million words in the nearest thing most Scottish folk have seed to written Scots. That's the heights that had to be conquered to reform Scots spelling. Sunday Post. So, apart from the things that I mentioned, as far as they've went, seems to me that the attempt at reform has just undermined the de facto standard, the language of Burns, has made it a truism among generations of collegianers and critics that Scots can't be a language because it has no written standard. Well, it did he. I want to finish by looking briefly at the development of Lallans magazine itself. From its beginning, Lallans was committed to what I've cried the wilder shores, a language revival, the reformed spelling, the synthesis of linguistic material for different dialects and time periods, and then all the creation on expository prose. Douglas Young in 1949 had called for prose writing in Scots, as he said, for the maintenance of the psychological health of the language. And the point was made repeatedly, for instance, by Geoffrey Wagner, by the Gaelic poet Derek Thompson, who sadly passed away earlier this year, and the David Murison, and more recently by Derek McClure, that Scots couldn't win to full language status afoot a full range of registers, including non-literary prose. As some of you will be aware, academic opinion on this point was heavily influenced by the views of the German sociologist of language, Heinz Kloss. Looking back after the first 10 years, Lallans' editor at the time, J.K. Anand, minded how difficult it was to fill the pages in the early days. He says, a bid to eke out the book with some scrivens in English or with swatches of the old lead for the old maesters, but this while back we again proof that it is possible to bring out a magazine Haley in Scots. And now, this is say 10 years on, there are furret looking pieces on topics that the Molly Granters said it wasn't possible to put into Scots. And then 12 years after, though, David Purvis, who was the editor for then, was writing, it is becoming ill to find waygate for all the poems and prose screeds sent in for consideration for Lallans. Mair and mair books is now being published in Scots, and there is a sair want of space to review them all. So that was a guy change in the first couple of decades. You know, being able to fill it to no hand space for all the material, a good quality that was offered. In the first issue, Anand Prigget would be contributors no to send in poetry. that in practice there was always yin or twee poems in issue, and over the years, as Lallans has established itself as the foremost outlet for Scriven in Scots, a succession of editors has bowed to the preferences of readers and writers by including mair and mair poetry. Back in 1978, I published an article in Lallans Macelle in order to experience its editorial policy. At the one time, I intended to write my PhD on the attempt to create a Scots expository prose. Annan's default position was to impose the style sheet, which some of you will mind was printed in the second issue of Lallans. But Lallans has always accepted Scrivens in regional varieties of Scots, and even Ginn contributors felt strongly in Uch in different would-be standard orthographies. And Lallans has me insisted neither on an extreme purity of Scots language, especially in poetry and in dialogue, where a full canon of Scots would be unnatural. It doesn't freak that writers maun plu just a narra fur of the linguistic continuum at the Scots end. As Donald Campbell screeved in an early issue, let's no be fear to sudden words, but let's pick them cannily. We maun mak sure when we wail a sudden word that it'll blend in weel wi'r Scots. This is in sharp contrast to Douglas Young, who criticises ilka poet for Gavin Douglas onwards, no excepting Burns, for Latin Anglicisms into their Scots. But better an English word nor a Scotsian thraw due to its ordinary sense or warsled into the rank context, like the Northern Irish use of cludges for toilets in signage in an arts centre in Oma. I got that through Wikipedia. My bibliography's gonna look kinda strange. But I did look around, and there's other photographs on the web, so there is corroborated evidence that and John will maybe has seen it as well as Struhl Arts Centre in Oma, cludges, which is inappropriate. It's colloquial. It's not the right register, but if you're determined to hear Scots word, that's where it leads you. So it's greatly to its credit that Lallans, the magazine, has never produced the kind of exaggeratedly English-avoidant text that has bottled the revival of Ulster Scots. There's always been an awareness that they overlap with English, that words like cat or narrative belong Scots just the same as English. Of course, as time goes on, the weir and dún of Scots words means that the area of overlap grows, and there is a danger that Scots is losing its distinctiveness. But for the outset, contributors to Lallans was judicious in the ISO archaisms and neologisms to compensate for this. Scots had already been through the hail plastic Scots dictionary dredging controversy with the Scottish Renaissance, an episode no exactly fondly minded on, as we saw with the Gowks and Audi Nows. As an anonymous critic screeved in Akros in 1969, a second flurin came in the 40s, but the Scots of the Fecalum was gay artificial stuff, panged foo in Etlin to achieve a full canon, o old fervent words that were never richt hefted into their lead. The contrast, its maturity of attitude and practice, has allowed Lallans not just to survive for this length of time, which must have seemed gay unlikely when it began, but I'll say to bring on a new generation of writers in poetry as well as in prose, which is not to say that expository prose was totally lacking afore Lallans. For instance, Lines Review published critical essays in Scots in 1957, and the magazine Akros had columns in Scots between 1968 and 1970. But though they were isolated tour de force, and they was often anonymous as well, but thanks to Lallans, we knew he a readership, which hardly existed when it began, for this genre, and a substantial bond of writers who are confident using Scots for prose in only yin o a number o orthographies. Thank you.